Being a lexicographer is an unusual profession. Being a lexicographer of Latin is so unusual that one gets used to having to explain from first principles what is involved, and also to being prepared at the drop of a hat to abandon the subject the moment a look either of boredom or of alarm becomes detectable in the eyes of one's interlocutor. That would never happen in Oxford, of course, and certainly not in the Bodleian this evening. But it may be worth reminding even this company of cognoscenti that what we are celebrating this evening is of significance on a world scale. There are, and for centuries have been, many complete dictionaries of Latin in existence, if by Latin one means the written language of the Roman Empire down to the first few centuries AD. One of the best and most authoritative of these, the well-known Oxford Latin Dictionary, heroically brought to a conclusion on almost this spot a few decades ago, itself constitutes such a comprehensive guide to classical Latin. But imagine you are an intelligent and long-lived yew tree, germinating in the year 250 and growing for over a millennium and a half in a continually populated centre of literate culture in, say, Spain or Italy or France. At first, the vocabulary you hear spoken by the educated human adults chatting around you is covered by a dictionary like that. But by the end of your life, if you are very long-lived indeed, it is to be found codified instead in a dictionary of Spanish, if you're in Spain, or French, if you're in France, or Italian, if you're in Italy. The former language has morphed into the latter. But what about the 1,000-plus years of a gap between the dictionaries? People haven't stopped talking, and they haven't stopped writing during that time. And millions of words of the text so written have in fact survived down to today. But where is the lexicographical coverage that interprets to us what they are saying? Well, the answer varies from country to country across Europe. Mostly under the auspices of national or regional academies, some 16 territorial dictionaries of the medieval Latin that I'm talking about have been under construction for years, or in most cases, decades. Some, like those being compiled in Spain, are like the yew tree in that they track the seamless development of their local vernaculars from something very like classical Latin down to something approaching the modern Romance tongues of their various areas. Others, like the work whose triumphant completion we're marking today, deal with a Latin that was never the everyday tongue of the regions they cover, but which nevertheless was in many ways the language in which the local medieval civilization enshrined itself for written transmission to posterity. The 16 dictionaries excavate those shrines and go on, as it were, to provide and constitute interpretative museums thereof. For England, that unique linguistic dig, that carefully curated display of words, that authoritative centre of cultural interpretation is the Dictionary of Medieval Latin from British sources. And this evening, it is complete. The first and public item on the menu for the celebrations is the lecture that I am here to introduce. DMLBS has been brought to completion by the unstinting labour and efficiency of the team working under the direction of Dr. Richard Ashdown, and he and they are very warmly to be congratulated. But it is this evening's speaker, Dr. David Howlett, who held the editorship for by far the longest period, who kept the ship on course during some fairly dire funding storms, and who more than any other stamped his impression on the work. I don't think anyone will begrudge my saying that DMLBS is really David's dictionary. It is a huge honour to me to be introducing him this evening, but as the editor of the most closely related of the 16 sister projects, I enjoy a uniquely privileged vantage point from which to do so. Working with Celtic Latinity as opposed to Anglo-Latinity, we in the Royal Irish Academies project find that our authors and texts nevertheless enjoy as close an intertwinedness with those of DMLBS as Ireland in practice always has with England. As a result, we have in our work such constant recourse to DMLBS that we have pressed its fascicles into service as soon as they've come out, and we can never spare them from the office for long enough to have them hardbound. Accordingly, the surfaces of our desks always display brown, soft-covered, dog-eared, much-thumbed and much-loved copies of the various letters. Dr. Howlett himself is also a much-valued member of our own editorial board, and the advice, wisdom and encouragement which he has always freely given us is worth a tribute in itself. But so is his knowledge, for Dr. Howlett is no mean expert in our corpus too, and his famous book, The Celtic Latin Tradition of Biblical Style, in its handsome green binding, is also a constant source of reference in our office. When I say that a frequent request from one member of our small team to another is, "Hand me green David, please," or "What does brown David say?" I think I have said all that needs to be said. To tell us the story of brown David, or DMLBS, I give you the editor emeritus himself, Dr. Howlett.
If we were to start now, we might want to make a dictionary of Latin from British sources, beginning with the introduction of the Latin language into Britain by the Romans, and continuing through the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, and the Neo-Latin period, right up to the present day. This would allow a user to observe usage in varied registers, from official inscriptions to demotic graffiti, from the high literary register of the works of Pelagius the Heresiarch and Faustus of Ries, fourth son of Vortigern, to the biblical Latin of St. Patrick, apostle of the Irish, and the rich trove emerging from Vindolanda as the foundations of a bright world in which we live today. For there is solid evidence from every period that the light introduced by the Romans, though sometimes dimmed, has never been completely extinguished. But since in lexicography, as in life, we must play the cards dealt to us, we can rejoice both at the hand allotted to us and at the successful completion of our game. The limits established by our predecessors extend through 1,100 years, from Gildas to Camden, from the 6th century to the year 1600. The earliest author in our canon, Gildas Sapiens, Gildas the Wise, was the heir of more than 500 years of Latin literary history in Britain. And he was rightly revered as the founder of five distinct but related literary traditions among the Welsh, the Irish, the English, the Bretons, and the Scots. The polished Latinity of Gildas illustrates a phenomenon uniquely precious in our tradition, for it is at once perfectly classical and biblical. It is rhythmical, exhibiting both clausular and cursus rhythms, snatches of verse, with hexameter endings and poetry scrambled into prose. Gildas writes 130 years after the departure of the legions of Latin as lingua nostra, our language, as distinct from the lingua Eius, their language, of the Saxons, incidentally recording the earliest extant written word of Old English, keula, boat, a word that survives in modern English as keel. If we compare the Latin of the post-Romano-Britain Gildas with that of the continental Gallo-Roman Gregory of Tours, we see something important. The latter labored under a difficulty shared with others throughout the Latin West. Although Gregory wrote Latin, he spoke Proto-French, as those in Ostrogothic Italy spoke Proto-Italian, and those in Visigothic Spain spoke Proto-Spanish. Languages as far removed from the Latin of Cicero as our English is from that of Chaucer. Their attempts to write classical Latin might be compared with our English if we tried to write the times and our wills in the language of Chaucer and Gower. But the Britons were different. At once the heirs of five centuries of Latin culture, and speakers of Proto-Old Welsh, a non-Romance language that did not interfere with their Latinity. As the composition of De Excidio Britanniae, published in 540, demonstrates clearly that Gildas had been both grammaticatus and rhetoricatus, instructed in both grammar and rhetoric, the structure of both primary and secondary education must have survived the fall of the empire, presumably in schools run by the church, collections of whose synodal acts from the 6th century onward show that it was flourishing, even in its supposed isolation. Gildas did not dumb down. He had an audience who could cope with his Latin, not only among his fellow Britons, but among the Irish. For Columban, a Leinsterman who had studied at Bangor, founded in the 550s, referred in a letter of the year 600 to Gildas and his correspondence with another Briton in Ireland, Finiaus, Finio, or Finbar. When the latter had consulted him about a canonical matter, Gildas elegantissime rescriptit, wrote back most elegantly. Columban spoke Old Irish, that did not interfere with his book Learned Latin, which is, like that of Gildas, perfectly correct, at once classical and biblical, and it compares favorably with the Latin of his correspondent, the native speaker Pope Gregory the Great. There is something further to note about Gildas, his name, which is not Britonic, nor Latin, nor Greek. Like Jonas, from Hebrew Yonah and the termination A-S, Gildas derives from Hebrew and Aramaic Gilda, skin, found at Job 16:15, with the termination A-S, meaning skinny, the equivalent of Latin macer, an appropriate name for an ascetic. With the name of the martyr Aaron that he records, Gildas is one of the earliest Hebrew names that were so widespread among the Britons. Amon, Amraphel, Anna, Asaph, Asser, Daniel, David, Enoch, Jacob, Samson. Among the Irish, Jonas and Reuben, and among English bishops, Daniel, Ithamar, and Tobias. This illustrates one aspect of a desire among Gildas and his countrymen not only to connect with the ancient Hebrew tradition, but to appropriate it. In explaining to his fellow countrymen why God was allowing the pagan Saxons to hammer his Christian people, Gildas wrote, "Ut in ista gente, ex perirator dominus solito more, presentem Israelem, utrum diligat eum annon." That in this people the Lord might in customary manner test the present Israel, whether it love him or not. Although it was a commonplace that the entire Christian church was the new Israel, no one before Gildas had ever identified a specific people as the new Israel. Here it is not part of an argument, but an obiter dictum to a people who do not need to be convinced of what they already believe. This arresting passage leads us directly to the earliest extant Anglo-Latin texts, and it affords a window into the minds of Anglo-Saxons and, incidentally, the beginnings of our lexicography. Shortly after the arrival of Theodore of Tarsus as Bishop of Canterbury and Hadrian the African as Abbot of Saints Peter and Paul Canterbury, these two men established from 670 a school that had no rival in Anglo-Saxon England. They had arrived with the Roman authority of Pope Vitalian, but their patriarchal sees had been Antioch and Alexandria, and they introduced their pupils to the learning of the Greek and even the Syriac East. Bede states in several places that graduates of this school knew Greek as well as they knew their mother tongue. Theodore and Hadrian also made their pupils read the established classics of Cambro and Hiberno Latin literatures, principally Gildas. We know this not only because the entire manuscript tradition funnels through Anglo-Saxon England, but because the first stage of creating a dictionary is to note difficult words that need explaining. A witness to this first stage is the Leyden Glossary, which is the first text on your handout in the upper left corner. This is extant in a 9th century manuscript, though the original issued late in the 7th century from the school of Theodore and Hadrian. The Leyden glossary is a batch glossary in which words are recorded not alphabetically, but in the order in which they occur in a distinctive text. The Leyden glossary contains three separate collections of words from Gildas de Excidio Britanniae, glossed in Latin, though elsewhere the glossary contains many Old English words. Evidence of close attention to this work reminds us that when one of Gildas's fellow Britons asked of the prizes Israel whether it loved God or not, his answer would naturally have been yes. But an Englishman would not agree. He would believe, on the contrary, that as the Britons did not love God, divine favor had been withdrawn from them and bestowed upon the English, who had thus been enabled to conquer parts of Britain and make of them English kingdoms, the English themselves now being prizes Israel. The idea that the English enjoyed a providential role in history is stated explicitly twice in The Life of Wilfrid by Ediusz Stefanos or Stephen of Ripon, published before 720. It is the principal theme of Bede's Ecclesiastical History of the English People, published in 735. Alcuin of York referred to this very passage of Gildas twice, once in a letter written after 8 June 793, after the sack of Lindisfarne by Vikings, to Archbishop Athelhard of Canterbury, warning that because of their moral failings, populi patriam perdiderunt, the people lost their fatherland. And again in a letter written in 797 to the people of Kent, warning that parentes Britannum perdiderunt regnum et patriam, the fathers of the British lost their realm and their fatherland. Wulfstan, Bishop of Worcester and Archbishop of York, had a personal collection of Alcuin's letters, a reading of which probably suggested reference to this same passage in his famous Sermo Lupi ad Anglos, preached in Old English in the year 1014. The most distinguished graduate of Theodore and Hadrian's school was Aldhelm, a member of the West Saxon royal house. Educated by the Irishman Maldub at Malmesbury, then by the Irishman Virgilius Maro Grammaticus at Iona, before being captivated about the age of 30 by the learning offered at Canterbury. Aldhelm became abbot of Malmesbury about 675 and first bishop of Sherborne from 705 until his death in 709. Anglo-Saxon writers regarded him as the preeminent Anglo-Latin author of both prose and verse, few of them escaping his influence for the next 400 years. And William of Malmesbury reported from the Enchiridion, or Liber Manualis, or Handbook of King Alfred the Great, that the king considered Aldhelm the preeminent Old English poet. From Aldhelm's time at Malmesbury, late in the 7th century, we have another glossary that illustrates the second stage of making a dictionary. And it is the first picture, the left-hand column, bottom. In the Apinal glossary, words collected from several batches are arranged in A order, that is, alphabetized usually by their first letter, and glossed in Latin and Old English. From Canterbury in the 8th century, at the top of the middle column, we have another glossary that exhibits a third stage of making a dictionary, the corpus glossary, in which words are arranged in AB order, that is, alphabetized by their first two letters. From the 10th century, we have yet another glossary that exhibits a fourth stage of making a dictionary, the Harley glossary, which is directly below the corpus, in which, though its most recent editor failed to notice, words are arranged in ABCD order, that is, alphabetized by their first four letters, with literae notabiliores marking the changes. This rich tradition is further enriched by a little glossary that survives in the Bodleian Library, on the dorse of a 12th century charter roll from St. Bennet Hume, Norfolk Rolls 81, which is the top of the right-hand column. In this, lemata are glossed not only in Latin, and several examples of hapax legomena in Old English, flod ofrena, cher huevo, and wind sieve, but also in Anglo-Norman Old French, one example of which, balbuisir, is not recorded in the first edition of the Anglo-Norman Dictionary. But the peculiar glory of the Cambro-Latin tradition is that it survives in unbroken continuity from Roman times among Britons who still regarded themselves as Romani, Cives, Christiani, Latini, and whose authors built upon the foundations that had been available to them in imperial times. Developing without reference to other sources, without flaunting their learning, and without degenerating, maintaining a high register of book-learned Latinity throughout what was everywhere else in Europe a dark age. And exporting this to Ireland and Brittany and Galicia in northwestern Spain, where the diocese was named Bretonia and the bishop's name was Malog. The peculiar glory of the Hiberno-Latin tradition is that it issues in two strands, from the mission of the man now identified by Dovio Cronin as the Poitevin Palladius, a papal deacon sent by Pope Celestine in 431, and from the mission of the Briton, St. Patrick, traditionally from 432, and maintaining a high register of book-learned Latinity from the 5th century till the 7th, devising a hierarchy of scripts, punctuation marks, construe marks, illumination, and above all, spaces between words. Soon after the death of Isidore, Bishop of Seville, in 636, and publication of his Etymologiae by his successor Braulio in 640, the works of Isidore and Boethius and Martianus Capella arrived in Ireland. The first clear evidence of knowledge of all three of these major writers out with their original milieu occurs among the Irish, beginning with a Latin poem that dates itself in three ways to the year 645. It came certainly with knowledge of the way in which 7th century Iberians pronounced and wrote Latin, and probably with knowledge of Hebrew. As the Irish were the first people with no historical experience of the Christian Roman Empire to learn Latin, they needed help that the Britons had not needed. And to fill that need, they devised new forms of grammatical instruction that issued in a large library of Latin grammars. These works show clearly that the Irish had access to a wide range of late antique grammatical texts, sometimes in forms better than have descended in the transmission of the grammatical texts themselves. And the same is true of computistical texts, the first of which was taught viva voce, a quodam Graeco sapiente, by a certain Greek wise man, to one of Columban's teachers at Bangor, who learned it memoraliter, by memory, before his death in 610, transmitting it to his pupil, who wrote it down and published it in 640. The peculiar glory of the Anglo-Latin tradition is that it issues in three strands. From the west, from Mercian kingdoms converted before the Gregorian mission by the Britons, who transmitted, among other things, the Orationes Morgani, extant in an 8th century Mercian royal prayer book. From the north, from the mission of the Irishman Columba at Iona from 563 onward, and from the southeast, from Augustine and his colleagues in the mission sent from Pope Gregory the Great in 597, reinforced by the later mission of Theodore and Hadrian from 670. Unlike the Britons, but like the Irish, the English needed help in the learning of Latin that native speakers would not need. They became accomplished grammarians and matricians, with Aldhelm, Bede, Alcuin, and Boniface, among others, compiling excellent new works which enabled the English to become the third insular people to speak and write Latin, correct and stylish, that astounded native speakers from the Carolingian court to the papal curia. The Anglo-Latin tradition exhibits two distinct styles, one of limpid clarity favored by the British and the Irish, practiced by Northerners and Westerners converted by the British and the Irish, the other of high rhetoric and recondite diction taught in the school of Theodore and Hadrian, practiced by Southerners. After the Viking depredations had nearly destroyed the centers of learning in the 9th century, a reflex of which we see in the abysmal language even of land charters from long-established centers like Canterbury, King Alfred the Great established monasteries to restore the tradition. His biographer, the Welshman Asser of St. David's, wrote in his Life of Alfred, published in 893, that he had seen in one of the king's foundations a Scandinavian boy who was by no means the most backward of pupils. Within two generations of this observation, the archbishops of both Canterbury and York bore Scandinavian names, Oda and Oskittel. The epigraphic tradition shows us monuments erected by men with names like Orm Gamalsuna, Tostig, Brandt, and Ertig. And the literary traditions preserve substantial texts by Latin writers like Turgot, from Old Norse Thorgautr, biographer of St. Margaret, Queen of Scotland, and Middle English authors like Lachman and Orm. In this we see the descendants of Scandinavian invaders, as before them the English themselves, drawn into the orbit of Latin culture, of which they became the most articulate exponents. This happened again with even more violently and more destructively, but with even more impressive subsequent developments among the Normans. These people, not very numerous, had conquered and maintained the Duchy of Normandy. Scandinavians, Northmen, as the name Normanni states, only recently Christian and Francophone, with the aid of landless Flemish knights and landless Breton knights. North Italian churchmen with Germanic names like Lanfrancus and Anselmus, and Jews to manage their financial affairs. And they brought these same peoples to England. The introduction of Jewish communities for the first time since the Roman era brought a reinforcement of the knowledge of Hebrew, and the introduction of Arabic, which features prominently in our dictionary. While in Normandy, the Normans had been Normanni, and their enemies, Franci. But after coming to England, they described themselves as Franci. When they went to Wales, they described themselves as Angli. And when they went to Ireland, their battle cry was St. Davi, continuously redefining themselves in terms of the people they had most recently lived among. Although Lanfranc, the first Norman Archbishop of Canterbury, removed English saints from the calendar, stating that if the English had really enjoyed divine favor, God would never have allowed the Normans to conquer them. Anselm, the second Norman Archbishop of Canterbury, restored them, agreeing that Archbishop Alfhea had been a true martyr. Historians utriusque generis with Norman fathers and English mothers, like William of Malmesbury, Henry of Huntingdon, and Ordericus Vitalis, began to rehabilitate the English past, both sacred and secular. Within one generation of the Norman conquest, Henry I married, on the 11th day of the 11th month of the year 1100, a princess, in Latin, Matilda, in Old French, Maud, in Middle English, Good Queen Mold, in Old English, Mathilda, daughter of St. Margaret, Queen of Scotland, and heir to the Anglo-Saxon throne. After which, William of Malmesbury praised Henry as the true refounder of the English nation. It is clear that in Normandy, Norman writers did not practice what I have tried elsewhere to define as biblical style. But as they adopted and practiced it in England, they became most vigorous practitioners. Norman administrators discovered immediately that the English, punctilious record keepers, had been writing laws, writs, charters, hagiography, chronicles, sermons, and poetry in vernacular Old English as well as in Latin since the end of the 6th century. But when the English wrote Latin, they wrote Latin. And when they wrote English, they wrote English. They kept their languages separate, and they even reserved distinct scripts for the separate languages. One good example of this can be seen in a facsimile of a burnt cotton manuscript in Wise's edition of Asser's Life of Alfred, in which vernacular names are written in a script different from the Latin text in which they are embedded. And another can be seen in the recension by the Norman Simeon of Durham of the Epistola Cuthberti de Obitu Vedae, in which the Old English verses of Bede's death song are written in a script different from the Latin in which they are embedded. but the Normans usually behaved differently. They spoke Old French every day, but they wrote only Latin, in which they were content to form words from their vernacular. After coming to England, they did something the English had seldom, if ever, done with their own vernacular. They used it to coin Latin words, and they did it by the hundred. In the Domesday Book of 1086, in charters, in translations of Old English law codes, imparting to Anglo-Latin a liveliness that it retained ever after. While the Normans were doing this, between the conquest and the reign of Henry II, they also devised, in England, as the true matrix of Old French, Anglo-Norman. From the beginnings of our tradition, insular peoples have always been interested in the tres linguae sacrae, Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. From the 7th century at the latest, acquisition of and competence in Greek and Hebrew are demonstrable. But the key was always Latin. Acquisition of and competence in Latin has gone hand in hand with creation of the earliest and richest vernacular literatures. First, Old Welsh. Second, Old Irish. Third, Old English. Fourth, Old Norse. Fifth, Old French. All here in these islands. This marks our medieval Latin as a national treasure of the highest value. How are we to present it? A lexicographer's job is like the flight of a bumblebee, theoretically impossible. He spends his time investigating quotations, formerly on slips of paper, latterly on the screen, asking, what does this say? And, not always the same thing, what does this mean? He must know his language thoroughly and apply that knowledge in order to distinguish fine shades of meaning. But he must suspend his judgment, at least momentarily, in order not to assume too quickly that he understands what he is reading, thereby missing something new or rare. He should pay attention at all times to etymology, but should remember simultaneously that all language is figurative and continually evolving. He should not have grand ideas, but confine his attention specifically to the word under consideration. He should be suspicious of the edition he is using, of the manuscript he is transcribing, of the drafts of his colleagues, and above all, of the opinions of earlier lexicographers. One who does this makes himself more or less unfit for life with his fellows, but he may eventually provide for his fellows a guide to the unknown. Exactly a century ago, Robert Whitwell proposed to the British Academy what became our enterprise. A collection of quotation slips on which to base the dictionary began in 1924, leading to publication of the medieval Latin word list from British and Irish sources in 1934. Ronald Latham produced the revised medieval Latin word list in 1965 and began to draft the dictionary after retiring as principal assistant keeper of the public records. He worked with two assistant editors and one editorial assistant, and a small army of volunteers, Anglican clergymen, a Benedictine monk, retired civil servants, and a few dons, who from their readings supplied quotations that numbered perhaps 400,000 or 500,000. The in-house library included a few books generously lent by the chairman of the supervising committee, Richard Hunt, keeper of Western manuscripts in the Bodleian Library, and Professor Sir Roger Miners. Also books borrowed from the Library of the Public Record Office and a few purchased for the dictionary itself. The room containing shelves with boxes of quotations and books and desks was on the north side of the north range of the PRO, with windows that had been boarded in the blackout during the Second World War and never opened since. There was a thick layer of dust that became thicker every time one consulted a volume of the roll series, bound in decomposing leather, so offensive that the assistant editor, Avril Powell, covered the entire set with brown paper. When, after cutting my lexicographical teeth as assistant editor of the supplement to the Oxford English Dictionary, I succeeded Ronald Latham as editor in January 1979, beginning aged 35, with admiration, even reverence, for the nature and scope of the enterprise, and for the constellation, rather the galaxy, of the names of the great and the good who have devised and advanced it. But there were hard choices, either to work part-time or to lose one assistant editor. After a three-day overlap with Latham, on contemplating the ways some things had been done and what remained to do, my heart began to sink. Latham had worked without a copy of the Thesaurus Linguae Latinae, and the Oxford Latin Dictionary was not yet complete. In January 1979, there were still sets of galley proofs dated 1975 that had not been returned because the editor, unaware that it then cost £1 to move a comma, had been using the galleys as rough copy that could be extensively revised. Some of the errors yet uncorrected were horrific, like the form quin titulatus, occurring in a list of synonyms for eunuch, obelized as erroneous and yet defined as infibulation of a eunuch. One wonders, cui bono? Though it was really a misprint for hisci intitulatu sinistro, to be whispered in our sinister list. Author's corrections alone for fascicule 2, the letter C, cost more than £11,000. And during the first year, the chairman, Richard Hunt, died on the very evening he was to come to dinner with my wife and me. Although my own father was still alive, I felt like an orphan. Yet the tale was not of unrelieved gloom. In reading the entire series of galley proofs, I recognized in the green ink of Oxford University Press's Learned Reader the handwriting of the finest copy editor possible, Leo Frank Holford-Strevens, already a legend while we were still undergraduates, and now the most invaluable support as he has continued till the end of the dictionary. From the Literary and Linguistic Computing Center of the University of Cambridge came an offer to enter text for the dictionary electronically, drastically speeding production and even more drastically reducing costs. Previously, we had used printed concordances only for works of Aldhelm in the 7th century and Bede's Historia in the 8th. Now the center supplied computer-generated word lists and concordances with keyword and context from major authors, Frithigoed and Wulfstan in the 10th century, Anselm in the 11th, William of Malmesbury, Ordericus Vitalis, and Geoffrey of Monmouth in the 12th, and later the Vitae Sanctorum Hiberniae, as well as concorded texts of the fascicles that were now set electronically, from which we could cite already verified words later in the alphabet. With the retirement of editorial assistant Joyce Batty and retirement and death of the assistant editor Kitty Thompson and part-time service of assistant editor Avril Powell, the volume of work to be done seemed daunting until the arrival of assistant editors Richard Sharp and Paul Staniforth. Many aspects of the dictionary that had seemed defective to me seemed defective also to Richard, but although I had gritted my teeth and accepted them, he persuaded me to change some. After 3 years of commuting by train and bicycle from Oxford to Paddington Station and Chancery Lane, I arranged to keep an office for Paul in the PRO, but moved the quotation slips and Richard and myself to the rooms on the top floor of the Clarendon Building, vacated by Peter Glare, as he completed the Oxford Latin Dictionary and moved next door to begin revision of the supplement to Little and Scott's Greek Lexicon. We thus acquired the invaluable experience and advice of Peter Glare and the services as editorial assistant for data entry of his colleague Lorna Lyons. We also acquired the right from the Bodleian to order books from the Bodleian stack that were not needed on open shelves, and the right to borrow others from the libraries of colleges and faculties. This, with a complete set of the roll series that I bought from copies kept as new, never sold, or returned as his cheap volumes for the tower of the PRO, gave us an admirable in-house library with direct access to other books on open shelves in the old library. To examine at least once every work on the bibliography, Richard and I ordered whatever the Bodleian held. an exercise that set him on his way to two prodigious works, the Bibliography of Celtic Latin Literature, 400 to 1200, and the even more astounding Hand List of the Latin Writers of Great Britain and Ireland before 1540. Books that might be made elsewhere by committees of national academies over decades, but completed by Richard in his spare time after attending to other duties. Since becoming editor in 1979, I had served as consultant to the Royal Irish Academy for the project Ludwig Bieler had persuaded it in 1949, the year of foundation of the Republic, to separate from ours as a Hiberno-Latin dictionary. I encouraged them to expand the remit to include the Latin of post-Roman Britain, Ireland, the Irish Peregrini on the continent, the Bretons, and the Scots. And the resulting work, now well on the way toward completion under the direction of Dr. Anthony Harvey, claims my greatest interest and admiration after our own. Richard's excellent bibliographical work did much to deepen the connection between our enterprises. Paul had come to us after completing a doctorate in Old French at the University of Exeter. After his interview on a Friday, I had rung him to ask whether he was inclined to accept the post. He replied, "No, I am prone to accept." Paul was, as well as an astute lexicographer, a poet who translated old Provençal verse into English in the meters of the troubadours. But he was also interested in Anglo-Norman, and so helpful to the editors of the Anglo-Norman Dictionary that they put his name with theirs on the title page, strengthening our association with a much-admired, closely related enterprise that has survived his much-lamented early death. Our associations with lexicographers at the Dictionary of Old English at the University of Toronto, the now completed Middle English Dictionary at the University of Michigan, and at the Oxford English Dictionary at Oxford University Press have been cordial, profitable to us, and we hope useful to them, as has our association with lexicographers at the Novum Glossarium Mediae Latinitatis at the Institut de France in Paris. Working for more than 33 years on the same enterprise has afforded many opportunities for learning on the job, improving techniques and conventions as one goes along, so that problems solvuntur ambulando in a way that we hope would please even Aristotle. Here follow a few that stand out in our memory. On your the second page of your handout, you see at the upper left-hand corner the word advocaria. We wouldn't do it like this now, because although advocaria is a perfectly intelligible Latin formation, the other forms that you'll see among the quotations, like avoeria, come from Anglo-Norman avoer, itself from advocaria. So we would now treat advocaria and advoaria as separate lemmata. Again, under aratura, the next word below, you'll see forms for aurora as well, which comes from Anglo-Norman arreur. And we now treat these as a completely Latin formation and as a Latin formation derived from Anglo-Norman, itself derived from Latin. On the other hand, there are words that appear in the dictionary as two separate lemmata, coverbus and cumerba, both of them meaning a coarb, a descendant, a hereditary descendant of the founder's family as abbot of an Irish monastery. The double entry was made by not taking into account that in both Irish and Welsh orthographic systems, intervocalic M linites to V, both of them pronounced V or even V, so that coverbus and coverba are really the same word, and we would now treat those together. Under Ericius, what we want is Ericius sense 4 that isn't on your sheet. But Ericius sense 4 means a palisade. And we had originally put, when we were drafting E, forms spelled Heriso under Erichius. We now think that's not a smart thing to do, and you'll find in fascicle for the letter H that we made a separate entry for Heriso, derived from Erichius and meaning identically spiked palisade. So we have learned as we've gone along how to improve our coverage. A wonderful pair of examples is ex aquare and estuari. Ex aquare means obviously to take water away, and the perfectly correct form is in Latin is that. But ex passes into Old French as es, and aqua ends up as French O, E-A-U, but in Anglo-Norman, E-W-E, U, survives in modern English as ewer, or indeed sewer. So, esseware is a Latin form derived from French, itself derived from Latin, meaning exactly like ex aquare, to take water away. But we distinguish these things. So you can see we learned between Erichius and ex aquare what we ought to be doing and have tried to do it ever since. I mentioned that the Anglo-Saxons barely, if ever, coined Latin words from their vernacular Old English. Two examples that appear to counter that are the one for Hanapus, which I had thought came from Anglo-Saxon knap, a cup or a goblet, until at a meeting of lexicographers in Barcelona, a Catalan informed me that no, this was a Catalan form. In any case, it requires more of an explanation than simply Anglo-Saxon. I think probably it is a late Latin vernacular demotic form that passes into other lexica than our own. Under Herietum, the first quotation was treated as Latin in the Regularis Concordia, where it's spelled as heriatua. But I think this is really an Old English form, herieatu, meaning army equipment, and that, as the quotation says, as this is what native speakers call the word. It isn't really a Latin word, and so that should come out. So the exiguous harvest of Latin words formed from Old English is now even more exiguous than it was. If you turn to the fascicule for the letter F, you will see a wonderful word, frithwitter, which puzzled Richard and me mightily, because it comes from very obvious Middle English elements, frith, peace, and witter, fine, and it ought to mean a fine for the breach of the peace. But it isn't found in any Old English dictionary, nor is it found in any legal formularies. We know, you can see the volume of evidence that we have for it is colossal. So we thought we would have to draft it. And once it was drafted, we noticed that in the lists of quittance clauses, frithwitter occurred in every case where you would otherwise expect either feardwitter, a fine for failing to support the army, or fichtwitter, a fine for fighting. Only one quotation had all three, feardwitter, fichtwitter, frithwitter, and that was what induced us to believe it was a real word. Well, it is a real word, but it doesn't refer to a real legal privilege. And yet, you can see for several hundred years, it had a legal life. So into the dictionary it goes. One of the delights of dealing with a large Latin corpus is that quite often we can tell what language a writer was thinking in. And a good example of this occurs under Tu Digitus, where it means a table, a high table. The men who wrote this, and you can see there's more than one or two of them, were thinking in Old French, in which droite meant both digit and table. And so, when these writers wanted to say table, they used a word that in old French meant table, but it came out as digitus. On the other hand, you'll see under latitudo pretty clear evidence that a man is thinking in Middle English. I leave my English book, legatum cum duobus latitudinibus, bound in two latitudes, because in Middle English, Breda, board, and Breda, broad, are homophones. So he writes that he gives his book bound in two latitudinibus. Now, this isn't a stupid person. This is clearly a literate man who owns books and is leaving them in his will. Under the form nautigeldum, there are many more examples than this little extract shows. It's a manorial rent paid in cattle. And the Middle English form for this ought to be neatgeld, neatgeld. But the Old Norse form is naut. And every one of these quotations comes from Cumberland and Westmoreland, which is an area of primary Norwegian settlement. So that although we have no evidence that Old Norse was spoken in these islands after the 12th century, here we have clear literary evidence of a person thinking, or many persons thinking in Middle English that has been heavily influenced by Old Norse. Under the form garillum, which again goes down for half a column in the dictionary, every single word spelled a different way. But it's quite clear what a garillum was. It was the wicker, a wicker frame that fitted between the stone palisades on the top of the castle so that you could walk along the top of the wall without being hit when you were not protected by the stone. We had to decide that the Anglo-Norman form for this should have been garoil, which would explain the variety of spellings that we had. One day it will appear in dictionaries of Old French, but it certainly didn't when we were drafting. It would be pretty dreary if we never got to play. Once upon a time, I received a letter from the editors of the Dictionary of Old English in Toronto asking if I could make any sense of infundiculum, which had a gloss, E-R-S-C-A-G. The Toronto editors had divided this as E-R-S-C, meaning stubble. So they wondered whether infundiculum was a funnel through which you poured stubble. And I thought, city girls. You burn stubble or blow it away. You don't pour it through funnels. But I treated myself to a journey to the British Library to look at the manuscript, which has nothing to do with agriculture at all. The text is a consideration of the seven deadly sins and their moral consequences. And this occurs in the margin, infundiculum, which is from infundere, passive infinitive, infundi, and culum, to insert something into the arse. And the Old English gloss, which is also a hapax legomenon, means arse key. Quoniam is better looked at than talked about. Because in Old French, Q-U was pronounced K, the word would have been pronounced quoniam. And we see from the quotations that it refers to female pudendum. A Middle English reflex of this you'll find in The Wife of Bath's Tale, in which she refers three times, one in each of her languages. She says her husband told her she had the best cunium, michtabe, and she referred to it as her belle chose and her quinta. Giraldus Cambrensis also makes merry with this word. But enough of that sort of stuff. I should refer also to a little pastime that occasionally my colleagues indulged in, which was the bogus entry, or at least the bogus quotation. Sometimes these have gone almost as far as galleys before they've been detected. My colleague Theo Christchev, in his hand, I'd found a quotation coming from Higden's Polychronicon that appeared to demonstrate that in the 14th century, Englishmen, when they would wish to be abusive, were calling Frenchmen frogs. This is under the entry for Rana. So I sent it off to John Simpson at the Oxford English Dictionary saying, isn't this interesting? And then thought, I should really have checked to see how Trevisa and the 15th century translator rendered Rana, and found, of course, the quotation didn't exist. So had to hot-foot it to the OED and retrieve this bogus quotation. But my favorite of all time was Pridwin Piper's quotation for Sagitta, arrow. You will see it's a bit small, but it reads, quamquam prius momento, secundam quosdam, super sageta illa enigmatice canebat heraldus, Anglicae lingua, cuius carminis tenor erat. It comes allegedly from William Poitier, historian of the Norman conquest. What drew my attention to it was reading the verses aloud and thought, these are heptasyllables. 11th century Frenchmen did not write heptasyllabic verse. 7th century Irishmen did, but not 11th century Frenchmen. And then I noticed that it was a varia lectio, but Guillaume de Poitiers survives in only one manuscript. The verses mean, I spy with Harold at the Battle of Hastings, of course, and the verses read, I spy with my little eye, something beginning with S. One day, when Richard Sharp and I were discussing improvements in our conventions, we agreed that a false electio could not have a definition. Its entry should begin with an obelus to mark error, followed by the form itself, and a comma, and FL. Correction should come in the quotation, within square brackets, marked MS, if the manuscript actually gave a correct form, later deformed by a copyist, or misrepresented by an editor. L for lege, if we were certain about the correct reading, and query L for query lege, if we were uncertain. When I said of this neat division that perhaps no reader would ever notice, Richard fell silent for a few moments and then said, do you know what this means? You and I are writing a dictionary of 6 million words for each other. Let us now praise famous men and our fathers who begat us, beginning with the authors, named and unnamed, on whose works we have based our dictionary, struggling to understand whose thoughts and expressions we have been stretched, enriched, and illuminated. Let us remember with gratitude those who imagined and fostered our enterprise, but did not live to enjoy its completion. Remembering our chairman, Richard Hunt, Christopher Brooke, Michael Winterbottom, Jim Adams, and Tobias Reinhardt, all our committee men, my predecessor, Ronald Latham, assistant editors, Kitty Thompson, Avril Powell, Richard Shaw, Paul Staniforth, John Blundell, Stephen O'Connor, Carolyn White, Theo Khrushchev, Trevor Evans, Pridwin Piper, Sheila Sneddon, Catherine Gowers, Richard Ashdown, Mark Thacker, Giuseppe Pizzini, and our editorial assistants, Joyce Batty, Lorna Lyons, Tina Chronopoulos, Pamela Armstrong, Christine Somerville, our XML and web developer, Tom Robo, and our deeply learned, gracious, and infinitely charitable consultant, Peter Glare. I know with St. Paul what it is to be surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. At the party to mark my retirement, I said that I thought my job the best in the world, and I still think so. Grateful that I could leave without singing the lay of the last survivor, knowing that trusted, competent colleagues would complete the work. So they have, and magnificently. Imperfect it may be, but we commend it to your use with every good wish. Legite feliciter.